Welcome to Volume 4 of Divers Down. Chapter 5, Southeast to Maui. The young people assigned to Julie's project made sandwiches in the big main cabin of the Westward and carried them topside, where they could eat and watch the sunset in the sea. Julie and Kip sat high on a work table affixed to the mainmast and munched thick beef sandwiches and sipped Coke. Kip congratulated himself on his foresight in asking her to hold seats for them while he made sandwiches. Alongside the mainmast, on a chest of life jackets, sat Chuck, Ski, Sato, Umi, Susan, and Johnny Keanu. Tom Shepard and Ann Bloom leaned on the rail. In the bow, watching the flying fish, were Willis, Poncho, Bob Richards, Carol Berquist, and Pete Jordan. With the five crewmen, the group totaled 20 people. Yet the schooner was not crowded. Kip marveled at the big, beautiful craft. From the outside, she hadn't seemed so large, and he hadn't imagined she could sail so fast. The taffrail log said she was making 6 knots, even on a tack, with her lee rail barely skimming the waves. He looked upward at the cloud of canvas that caught the red hues of the setting sun. The Westward was brigantine rigged, a huge square sail on the foremast, a Marconi on the mainmast, and a staysail in between. Now and then her bowsprit dipped into the water and spray flew the length of the ship. The sun was a red ball sinking into the western Pacific, and pink clouds fringed the horizon. Waves driven by the trade wind piled high around them, and spume flew from the curling tops. Kip was enjoying it so much he could feel a happy tickling in the pit of his stomach. The red sun dipped below the horizon. The brief tropic twilight dimmed, and suddenly it was dark. Pete Jordan called, "All divers, gather at the mainmast." Kip and Julie stayed where they were, and the others gathered around them. "Get comfortable," Pete instructed. "Sit on the deck or hang from the rigging." When they all found places, Pete held up a hand for attention. "Most of you don't know much more than the rumors about a wreck. So we're going to fill in the background. I guess you all know Julie Scott. It's her second year with us, and she's about to see the operational phase of her personal 2-year project. And you're all here to help. Julie?"
"Yes, Pete, thank you. Pardon me, everybody, if I chatter a bit. I'm really excited about this."
There were approving chuckles from the listeners.
"Well, my project was to try to find a Hawaiian wreck that could be recovered and used as an authentic exhibit at Sea Life Park. I spent all last summer searching the archives, working with people at Bishop Museum, and poring over old volumes in the library. Some good examples of primitive Hawaiian canoe building have been recovered through the same kind of careful research I was doing. Others have been discovered by accident when some lucky diver bumped into them. Anyway, it was no easy task that I got myself into, and after months of discouragement, I got sidetracked in my research. The history of Hawaii is fascinating reading. I was following a story of a religious upheaval that occurred in the 1860s, reading in the journal of an English-born teacher named Roger Young, and suddenly it jumped right out at me. The canoe I'd almost given up looking for."
Kip handed Julie a Coke. She paused for a sip, while the others waited anxiously for more of her story. The waves and the creak of the rigging made a rhythmic accompaniment to her voice when she began again.
"I know these names don't mean much to you, yet our destination is Hana, which is on the tip of the island of Maui. On April 2, 1868, Roger Young saw a canoe sink there under exciting and mysterious circumstances. Now this may sound too romantic to be true, but here it is. A religious cult on the island worshipped an unusual idol god."
"Better explain why the idol was unusual," Pete suggested, interrupting Julie. "Don't hurry. We're enjoying your story."
There were sounds of unanimous agreement from the lamp-lit figures scattered around the deck.
"Well,"
Julie continued,
"it's because the Hawaiians always made their idols from wood or wicker work, almost never from stone. But this idol, who is called Kane, was carved of dense lava and weighed about 400 pounds.
Kip noticed that Umi had risen and gone to the railing. The Hawaiian boy was staring out over the moonlit sea.
"Anyway,"
Julie went on,
"the other islanders were afraid of this cult, so they burned their temple and drove them from the island. The cult rescued the stone idol and planned to start again on another island. They needed a special canoe to float Kane to a new home, so they built one with a platform especially for him. The canoe was unusual too because it was a mixture of Hawaiian and Cook Island. Instead of a hollowed-out log for a hull with a higher freeboard added, which was the Hawaiian style, the dugout part was just the base with the sides built up from planks sewn together with sennit.
Umi had turned. He was intent on Julie's words. He was leaning forward, tensely smacking a fist into his palm, noiselessly, rhythmically.
Here's the amazing part of the story. When they were on their way in the canoe with Kane, the volcano Mauna Loa on Hawaii erupted. There was a huge tidal wave. Roger Young saw this from shore. Kane tipped over and fell off his platform. He cracked open the canoe bottom, and because of all that weight, the canoe went straight down into about 40 feet of water. Two men were killed. Kane fell on one and another drowned. Two survivors reached shore, where Roger Young and his wife helped them, but as soon as they were well, they just disappeared. The underwater sand surge with the tidal wave must have covered the canoe almost at once, because it's never been accidentally located. There are no other records of the sinking either, and so it's still there now, just waiting for us.
Susan Manning broke the awed silence of the listeners.
How on earth did you ever dig out this story, Julie?
Julie smiled.
It was really an accident. At first, I kept finding little clues in places like the old newspaper, the Sandwich Islands Gazette, and the proceedings of the Missionary Society. And they led me to Roger Young's journal. He had written down everything during his stay teaching on the island. Some of it was pretty dull. That's probably why it's never been extensively researched before. But Roger Young was somewhat of a scientist and a very meticulous man. He ran up and down the shore and sighted on the canoe as it sank, and he named his landmarks with the big island as a reference. Tap Pryor took aerial photos for me, and I had them blown up so that I could identify the landmarks. Then I plotted them and the sightings on a chart and determined the probable location of the canoe.
Well, there can't be much of it left, Willis stated flatly. Kip bristled at this.
We'll know tomorrow,
replied Julie coolly.
Normally, shipworms and other borers might have destroyed the canoe, but this canoe was buried deeply in the sand almost immediately, so there's a good chance that Willis is wrong.
Pete Jordan asked.
Weren't those old canoes given names, Julie?
Yes, Pete. This one was christened the Ilokai, which is the Hawaiian word for the surface of the sea.
I needn't tell you why we're pretty proud of Julie, Pete told the group. No professional could have done better. She gave Tap Pryor her chart with a circle showing the probable location of the wreck. Tap flew down there last Monday. He dove, located the canoe within 30 feet of the center of Julie's circle. Julie smiled happily.
Tomorrow we'll all dive and uncover enough of the canoe to see what condition it's in. And most especially, we want to see if Kane is there. A canoe in good condition would be great, but an authentic statue of Kane would be absolutely marvelous. The scientists at Bishop Museum would just blow their minds. We've promised they can have it to study first if it's really there.
Umi pushed through the circle now, and seeing his horrified expression, the kids jumped to their feet.
No! Umi whispered urgently. No! We don't get that canoe topside! I tell! That Kane, he gonna kill somebody for sure!
Johnny Keanu stepped to Umi's side.
Didn't you know we were going after that old canoe, Umi?
Oh, you no tell Umi about Kane. What's the matter, you Johnny Keanu? You Kanaka like me, you know that Kane, he got plenty mana.
Willis snickered.
Wow, hear that, gang? We have to leave the canoe on the bottom because the god will blast us. Boy, scratch a Hawaiian and you get nothing but a shivering native who's afraid of spooks.
Kip saw red. He leapt to the deck and faced Willis, poised to spring.
Shut that big mouth of yours, he lashed out. Umi has a right to his beliefs without wise-ass comments from you. If you want to make cracks about anyone, try making them about me.
Willis, surprised, recoiled for an instant, then stepped forward. Watch it, Morgan. Big Johnny stepped between them, and Pete closed in.
Knock it off,
Johnny commanded.
I'll beat his face in, Willis grated.
Let him try, Kip urged. He thought he was fast enough to compensate for McKay's greater size and longer reach, and he longed to cut the supercilious creep down to almost human.
Go forward. Break this up, he ordered to Willis. And any more cracks about natives, and I might just let Kip teach you better manners. Go on, get forward. And you and Kip stay out of each other's way. That's an order.
Willis moved to the bow, and in a few moments his friends gathered round him. Kip, still tense and trembling with anger, turned to Umi and saw the girls clustered protectively close to the Hawaiian boy, trying to calm him.
You one sweet Hali Wahini, Umi said earnestly to Julie. You're gonna be no homakapui if you try to get that kane topside.
His eyes pleaded with Kip.
You gotta keep your wahini away from that kane. Kane get more poo. Maybe send lapu. Maybe oio. He got plenty mana, I tell, even in the bottom of ocean.
Johnny spoke to Umi in Hawaiian. He led the protesting boy away. Kip and his friends found seats on the life preserver locker. They were all shaken at Umi's distress. Julie moved close to Kip and took his hand.
He's so upset, she said miserably. I never thought about his reaction to Kane. I knew he came from a place where the old beliefs are strong, and if I hadn't been so enthusiastic, I might have led up to it a little better.
Sato shook his head.
It wouldn't have helped, Julie. When you've been brought up as Umi has, the old beliefs become part of you.
Poor kid,
Anne Bloom said softly.
He was so disturbed he used more Hawaiian than English. I didn't understand half of what he said. Sato can tell us,
Susan suggested. Sato nodded.
He's afraid of Kane's mana. Mana is power, the kind a god is said to have. He said Kane would want a mo'opu, a human sacrifice. And he said Kane might send a lapu, which is a nasty kind of ghost, or even an o'io, which is a whole parade of ghosts that kill people.
What did he say about Julie? Kip asked.
He said she was going to be in real trouble if she tried to raise the statue of Kane.
What can we do? Chuck Reed asked. Sato shrugged.
Leave it to Johnny. He was brought up in the same kind of village, so he understands how Umi feels. He had to shed the same beliefs.
Maybe the old beliefs are right, Skeet said slowly. How do we know?
Tom Shepard clapped a hand to his forehead.
Yowie! All we need now is a ghost-ridden howling blockhead to make the evening complete. Snap out of it, Ski. Come on, kids. I have a hunch we got a busy day ahead.
They trooped down the midship ladder, ignoring the group in the bow, and said goodnight in subdued voices. Kip walked with Julie and Susan to the cabin they shared. Don't get too upset over Umi, he said gently. Johnny will get him squared away. Julie started to speak, then just nodded and gave him a half-sad, half-sweet smile. Kip headed to his own bunk. Between Umi's upset over Kane and Julie's distress over Umi, tomorrow promised to be quite a day. Chapter 6. The Wreck of the Ilokai. Kip awoke to the vibration of the Westward's diesel engine and realized the schooner was no longer under sail. He parted the curtains of his bunk and looked out into the main salon. Sato, Tom, and Ski already were eating breakfast with Poncho, Susan, and Carol. On both sides of the salon were bunks set in alcoves, with heavy curtains to keep out light and noise. It was much like sleeping in a berth on a train. The boys were assigned to the alcoves while the girls shared double cabins. Kip slipped into denim shorts, washed up, ate a hurried breakfast, and ran topside. The ship's sails were neatly furled, and she was proceeding under power toward Maui. Kip saw Julie, Anne, Pete, and Johnny in the bow and joined them. After they exchanged greetings, he asked Johnny, "How's Umi?"
"He's calmed down. He'll stay ashore today and talk to a kahuna we know."
Kip stared. "You mean there are actually kahunas in Hawaii? Even today?"
"Sure. There'll be kahunas as long as the Hawaiians are pure blood. They're no longer so powerful. but they do have influence. The kahuna at Hana is a fine guy. He'll get Umi back on the track.
Kip sincerely hoped so. Umi's distress had been very real, affecting all his friends. Julie's smile still showed traces of last night's upset. She wasn't her buoyant self this morning.
Isn't Maui spectacular, Kip?
She asked. And indeed it was. The shoreline varied from a few white beaches at the sea end of valleys to magnificent cliffs where the sea had shorn the land away, leaving escarpments of sheer volcanic rock. Behind the rugged shoreline, the green land rose abruptly until the slopes were lost in a necklace of clouds. Kip knew that above the clouds, soaring to more than 10,000 feet, was the crater of the sun, the great extinct volcano, Haleakala. High on the mountain, the clouds poured out rain to feed the clear streams of Maui. Many ended at cliffs over which great water veils tumbled. Pete pointed to where the land curved to the south. Hana's over there. I'd better pipe all hands. Time to get organized. When the group was assembled, Pete bade them good morning. Okay, kids, here's the drill. At Hana, we all transfer to the Holokai. All the gear you need is aboard, except for your personal equipment, which you will take. Tony Angelo, Makai's chief diver, will be dive master, and he will brief you. Keep our purpose in mind. We want to uncover enough of the Ilokai to see its condition and take measurements. Julie?
Mostly we have to watch for loose pieces,
Julie said.
Collect anything you see, but please don't remove anything that is attached in any way, and try not to scar the wood. If you find anything, notice position and tell me later.
Pete nodded. If anything develops you don't know how to handle, stop and ask Julie, but work steadily. We don't want any problems with decompression, and we don't want to risk bending any of you, so limit of downtime is 1 hour each. By bending any of them, Pete meant risking the bends, caused when nitrogen is absorbed under pressure too suddenly and released into tissues, joints, and bloodstream after a diver is down long enough to absorb the gas. Kip knew the diving tables, and 1 hour at less than 50 feet gave them more than a half-hour safety margin. Pete Jordan took a list from his pocket. We will rotate teams for bottom work. The supervisors will be there to advise, but we want you kids to do the job because doing is the best way to learn. Julie is a photographer, so she will document the dive as well as assess the wreck. Kip Morgan will be her partner, responsible for measurements. Kip, we want full dimensional information. If Willis McKay had had the mana of a Hawaiian god, his look at Kip would have killed instantly. Pete pointed at Willis. You will be in charge of excavation. That means you'll be in and out of the water, and you'll have to plan a dive schedule with Tony Angelo. Willis accepted the responsibility as no more than his proper due. The excavation was the key to the whole operation. Kip felt a twinge of jealousy. He guessed Pete had given him the easiest job because he was the youngest and greenest, not to be trusted with supervising or handling a sandsucker hose. But having Julie as his dive partner made up for it. We cannot just excavate haphazardly, Pete continued. We have to adjust the plan as we go. So I want Ann Bloom to partner with Willis. Ann, I know how rapidly you can sketch, and after each dive I'd like you to keep a running record on a blackboard. We'll use your sketches as a guide. Can do?
Can do,
Ann agreed quickly.
Fine. Excavation teams by pairs will be Palakowski and Reed, Punaloa and Avalar, Richards and Shepard. Susan and Carol will be on biological operations. Tell us, Sue.
We're to collect specimens from around the wreck so that the Institute can have a sample collection of organisms that congregate around wooden objects on a sand sea floor. We have bug bags and slurp tubes on the Holokai and jars of formalin.
Pete interjected. There won't be much fish life, if any. It's a barren area with no food to attract fish. The girls will be after the animals that live in the bottom.
That's right, Susan agreed. But if we see a fish, we'll grab him.
Very good, Susan. Hana ahead, kids. Get into your swimsuits, but carry clothes to the Holokai. When you surface, you may feel a little chilled.
Kip went below and changed into his swim shorts, made up a roll of sweatshirt and slacks, and took his gear bag. He arrived back on deck as the schooner nosed into the dock and tied up opposite the Holokai, Makapu'u's big ocean engineering support ship. The concrete dock was in a quiet, green-edged cove, and the Makapu'u vessels had it to themselves. Among the trees on the shore was an open space, with a couple of small sheds that seemed to be stands for a picnic area at the dock's end. As Kip looked, Tap Pryor drove up in a station wagon. Pete got on the loudspeaker.
"Let's go, divers. Take your gear to the Holokai. We'll pull out in 2 minutes."
Julie joined Kip just as Umi came from below, carrying his bag. He was subdued, but he had an affectionate smile for both of them.
"From last night, I got plenty aloha for you good kids," he said sincerely. "Mahalo, that means thanks. Johnny tell, aste hana. Maybe so I come Makapu'u 1 week."
"We'll miss you, Umi," Julie said.
"I miss you too, Julie. Kip, you gotta take plenty care of you wahine, you hear?"
"I will," Kip assured him. "So long, Umi." He and Julie carried their gear up the Holokai's gangplank. Susan and Carol were already unpacking some equipment. Carol had a bug bag, a sack with a hinged opening like a lady's purse. It was of a finer mesh than the bags used to collect lobsters. Susan lifted out a clear plastic gadget. The open end was a plastic tube that fitted into a larger cylindrical chamber. The chamber was fitted with a plunger attached to a steel rod that went through the back wall of the cylinder and curved to a handle. "What is that?" Kip asked. Susan demonstrated.
"You spot a tiny sea animal, put the open end near him, and pull the handle. Slurp! He's pulled in. Push the handle, and out he goes into the bug bag. It's called a slurp tube."
Pete Jordan counted noses. All were aboard, including Tap Pryor. The Holokai cast off and moved through the reef entrance. Tony Angelo, a short, powerfully muscled man, called the group together on the fantail and briefed them on diving procedures.
"We're following Navy diving tables. As you know, the Navy tables are fine for most people most of the time, but on rare occasions someone gets bent. We will take no chances whatsoever because there's no decompression chamber nearer than Kahului. That's why each person will be limited to one dive for 1 hour, which gives us a 40-minute safety pad. You must, repeat must, take a full minute to ascend and make a positive effort to get the compressed air out of your lungs. Exhale, then exhale some more. We want no gas embolisms from failure to clear your lungs. I know you're all qualified divers and you wouldn't be here if you weren't, so I'm saying what you already know. But don't brush it off. Twin tanks for everybody. Wear scuba comms and watches. That's it."
The ship was now anchored so it would drift to a stop directly over the wreck, which Tap Pryor had marked with a small plastic buoy. He was an interested observer, but had faith in his staff and was content to listen and watch. Kip selected double tanks for himself and Julie, attached their personal regulators, and tested pressure and gas flow. Satisfied, he put the scuba tanks aside. He and Julie would be in and out of the water, but they wouldn't dive until the excavation crew had something for them to see. Johnny Keanu and the sandsucker crews had hooked up big 6-inch hoses to a powerful pump on the afterdeck. The suction would be used at the wreck, and the discharge would be placed down current so the fine particles wouldn't drift over the excavation and ruin visibility. Tony Angelo called,
"First divers down, Willis and Ann with me."
The trio stepped from the deck feet first, and Kip saw them finning downward through the clear water. Within minutes, they were up again, treading water while Willis tapped his mouthpiece and called importantly,
"Team 1 in. Let's go."
Ski and Chuck dropped into the water. The teams on the deck fed hose down until slack showed that the ends were on the bottom. The hoses moved as the team below adjusted them. Tony climbed out onto the diver's platform under the ladder and called,
"All yours, Johnny."
Johnny told the crewman of the pump,
"Give us suction in exactly 2 minutes.
He motioned to the girls.
"Susan, Carol, come on."
He went over, followed by the girls with bug bag and slurp tube. Kip saw them fin down the buoy line. He could see the divers against the white sand. The pump started up with a whine that turned to a grinding roar as sand poured through. And in a few moments, they saw a whitish underwater cloud rising on the downcurrent side of the ship. Julie was watching quietly. Kip said gently, "It's hard to be patient."
"Yes,"
Julie agreed. She added wistfully,
"If only we could see what they're doing."
After what seemed an hour, but was actually only 10 minutes, Willis and Anne surfaced and climbed aboard.
"It's there, Julie,"
Anne said excitedly.
"We uncovered wood, and it seems to be in good shape."
Pete and Tony had brought a blackboard on deck and mounted it against the side of the wheelhouse. Anne dried her hands, picked up chalk, and sketched quickly.
"I don't see how Mr. Pryor ever found it. We couldn't have told it from the rest of the sand floor without the buoy."
It was the only slight irregularity in the current ripple marks on the sand within the circle on Julie's chart, Tap Pryor explained. "If she hadn't been so accurate, I'd have never found it. I probed with a hand core until I hit wood." Kip knew that Julie's accuracy wasn't luck. She had spent weeks sifting through data gathered by the university scientists, even calculating the distance spring currents would drift the canoe as it sank. She had studied the area charts and plotted and replotted the sightings Roger Young had made, constantly refining the canoe's location until she arrived at the circle of highest probability. Her calculations were the superb work of a first-class mind. Anne Bloom's sketch showed the hollow where excavation had begun. She showed where the first wood had been.
"We can't tell yet what part of the canoe it is. I looked for wormholes, but I didn't see any."
Johnny Keanu surfaced and came to the deck.
"It's going well," he reported. "The kids are doing fine with the hose. They're pulling sand away to make a hole to work in before they try to uncover any large sections of the canoe. The girls have a few squirmy specimens, too."
A 5-minute warning sounded the approaching end of the first hour. Willis and Anne went down with the replacement team. Ski and Chuck surfaced, followed by Susan and Carol.
"We'll have something for you in about 10 minutes,
Chuck told Julie and Kip.
"It's in good condition,"
Susan reported.
"The wood is soft but not wormy, and we have lots of specimens, but only one fish and one piece of wood."
Kip and Julie examined the wood, a piece about an inch wide and an inch thick, a splintered triangle in shape. It was spongy and easily dented with a finger. Julie carried it off to show Tap and Pete, while Kip helped the girls remove their tanks. He watched as they upended the bug bag into a white enamel tray. They had a remarkable collection of wriggly creatures.
"Aren't they simply gorgeous?"
Susan demanded ecstatically. To Kip, they were just an assortment of worms, shellfish, and bugs, some brightly colored, some segmented, and some just blobs. But Susan and Carol, obviously, were in some peculiar biological heaven, and he agreed. "They're great." Julie, returning, stifled to chuckle. As the girls carried their specimens to waiting jars, she said,
"Your face didn't match your words, but it was a good try at being nice, Kip."
Willis and Anne returned, and Anne sketched a sunken area from which the sand had been removed, and a place where wood showed in a shape that could only be the end of the canoe. Sato, who had gone down with Team 2, broke surface and called,
"We just uncovered the outrigger!"
Julie looked at Kip, brown eyes pleading. He turned to Tony. "We better go down."
"Okay, don't use up too much of your time. Not more than 10 minutes.
Kip held Julie's tank while she adjusted the harness, then swung his own over his head. In a few moments they were ready. They jumped together as the cool water closed over them. Kip let Julie get a little ahead so he could see the action of her bubbles. He knew she was excited, but her breathing wasn't too fast. Satisfied, he came level with her, enjoying the sensation of pure freedom diving always gave him and the flow of the water along his skin. Below, he could see the sand team working, and his eyes followed the black line of the big hose to the sand pouring in a cloud from one end. He could see dark areas and the yellow-white sand at the suction end that could only be part of the wreck hull. Julie swam at once to the bow section. It was now apparent that the curve of the wood could only be the bow. She ran her hands over the wood and put her mask close. There wasn't room for Kip to squeeze in for a look. Instead, he looked around. They were in an undersea sand desert, the bottom riffled with patterns made by the currents. The divers were the only living things in sight. He felt the current drift him gently, but it wasn't too strong. The big rushes of current came when the trade winds were shifting. He joined Julie in her examination of a long strip of wood that was barely showing. This was the canoe's outrigger. It was carved, but he could not make out the design. The wood gave under his probing finger. No wonder, he thought, after a century of soaking. He guessed it would be about as strong as a piece of cheddar cheese. He began to speculate on how it could be raised in one piece. It began to seem probable that it was still whole. His watch showed 9 minutes gone. He hated to pull Julie away, but they had to conserve their downtime until enough of the canoe was uncovered to permit measurements. He took her hand and motioned upward. She nodded, and they headed to the surface, going slowly. As they swung onto the diver's platform and climbed to the deck, Julie asked,
"How long?"
Kip knew what she meant. "Another half an hour, and we should be able to start measuring. They have a lot of sand to get rid of, just to uncover the gunwales."
"All right, I'll be patient."
Kip got a steel tape from Pete. He would take notes on the kind of board he had used as a child to scribble pictures on, a translucent plastic sheet over a soft, black plastic board. Writing with a stylus pressed the white sheet into the black, and the black lines showed through, lifting the white sheet erased the marks. Just before the second shift ended, Willis called Bob and Tom to the blackboard. "We have most of the top layer of sand removed. We'll uncover the canoe gunrails first, and then pull sand from the middle section down the keel line. Last, we go to the stern and uncover the keel there. We'll work on just one side, unless Julie wants something on the other side, and we'll take away only enough sand for measurements to be taken. If we get too much sand removed, then the canoe may collapse, because the wood's so soft." Willis was using his head, Kip saw. He wondered if he would have done as well. Now and then, one of the adults went over and dove down to the wreck, but the teams were doing fine and they didn't comment or interfere. Anne's sketches showed rapid progress. A moment after the last team went in, Willis surfaced and called,
"Julie."
Kip and Julie were on the bottom in seconds. The hose team had excavated great gouges in the sand, exposing one side of the bow. As they watched, the new team guided the hose along the gunwales, which showed through as flat black lines. In a few moments, the gunwales were clear, and Kip could see that the bow and stern were decked over. The team got to work on the midsection. Julie took photos, then probed where the hose was excavating. She beckoned to Willis and motioned to excavate more toward the stern. Willis got the hose placed, then used his scuba comm to say,
"Our time's up. Follow Julie's orders. Come on, Anne."
Kip got busy. He measured the canoe's depth at the bow, then sketched the sweep of the bow line. He saw that the bow was carved to resemble a shark's head and recalled that Kane was the shark god, among other things. Julie was shaking her head when he looked. She used her scuba comm to give instructions.
"Do stern, then come back to other side opposite here."
While Tom and Bob carried the hose to the stern, Kip measured the beam of the canoe from gunwale to gunwale and found it to be an inch short of 5 feet. He saw in the excavation that the sides were built up of planks held together at the seams with coconut fiber lashings. Motioning to Julie, he had her hold the tape at the opposite gunwale while he bent it down at a right angle to measure the depth to the keel and estimate the hull's curvature. He knew he had a good eye for angles and distances, and he was confident that his measurements would be close enough. Again, getting Julie to help, he put her hand on the end of the tape in the bow. Moving along the gunwale, he pressed the tape down until he got to the stern tip. Allowing for the curve of the gunwales from bow to stern, he estimated the canoe to be 27 feet long, give or take an inch. He would calculate it precisely later. Thanking Julie with a nod, he reeled in the tape. He had an excellent idea of the canoe's shape and dimensions now. He sketched his outline and marked in the figures. Bob and Tom finished at the stern and moved amidship to the opposite side. Kip measured the stern depth and shape more accurately. By the time he had finished, Julie was calling him on the scuba comm. He swam to her side, and together they looked down at a newly excavated hole to where a shaped piece of black rock thrust through the canoe bottom, slightly to one side of the center line of the keel. It was Kane himself, as Julie had foretold. She had pegged its location precisely. As she took photos, Kip felt a hand on his shoulder. Pete, Tony, and Johnny had arrived with Tap prior. No one else had that mass of blonde hair. Tap used his scuba comm after Julie showed him the visible bit of Kane.
Cover statue lightly. Use rest of the time to fill deep holes.
Kip knew what the center chief had in mind. Time would pass before they returned, and he wanted no strange divers to see the statue. Filling the deep holes was to prevent possible wave action damage to the canoe. Kip looked at his watch. He and Julie had only a minute left. While the adults gave the sand team a hand, he took her arm and pointed up. They finned to the surface, bubbles rising before them. Kip knew Julie's mind wasn't on diving, so he kept an eye on his watch for both of them, taking the full time to ascend. He watched to be sure she was exhaling properly. She was, but he guessed it was automatic rather than deliberate. Julie was out onto the platform and up the ladder before he was even out of the water. She wasn't in sight when he got to the deck and shed his gear. The kids uncovered part of the statue, he reported. Now they're covering it again and filling in the deepest holes. When he looked for Julie, she was in the bow, her eyes wet with tears that mingled with the salt water from her hair. Kip smiled and gently lifted the double tank she still wore while she undid the harness release. He knew it wasn't sorrow that was making her cry. He leaned the tank toward the rail and offered her a towel. Julie sniffled softly and dried her face.
It's all there, Kip. It's really there, even Kane. Do you know how it is to live with a dream for more than a year?
I think I do.
The research all added up, and I was very sure, only there was that little cloud of doubt, you know? I had to see it and touch it, and when I did, I wanted to cry from pure joy and relief. Only it's not a good idea to get a runny nose underwater.
He laughed with her. I know how you must feel.
I think you really do. Oh, Kip, I saw enough of Kane to know he's a real prize, even more important than the canoe.
She took a deep breath.
Now we have to make plans. I won't be really satisfied until Kane and the Ilokai are safe at Sea Life Park. Raising them won't be easy.
Kip had an idea about that. While measuring, he had puzzled over the problem of salvaging the canoe in one piece. He knew it was fragile, though the wood was as good as could be hoped for after a century in the sea. The sennit fibers that held the planks together seemed frayed but intact. Even so, he suspected that the strength was leached out of them. They would not even take slight stress. To compound the problem, he knew there was little interior bracing in the canoe. I have an idea of how we can get it up, he said. He outlined the approach. Julie's eyes widened.
Oh my God, that would work, Kip!
I think it might, he agreed. But Pete is a top-notch pro, and it'll be great seeing how he does it. I'll learn more engineering by watching than I'll ever learn from textbooks. Julie nodded soberly, but there was a hint of mischief in her brown eyes, as though she knew something that Kip didn't. Kip was busy turning his idea over and over in his mind, seeking flaws, so he didn't notice Julie's secret look.